Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the Trampoline Hall podcast. I am your host, Misha Globerman. Trampoline Hall is a lecture series that takes place in a bar in Toronto and also inside of your head because of podcasts. There is one rule at Trampoline Hall, which is that lecturers cannot be professionally expert on the subject on which they are speaking. It can't be their job to know about their topic. After the lecture, there is a question and answer period with the audience, which is a really big part of the show. So in general, to come to Trampoline Hall, you go out and you buy a ticket. Tickets are $5. They're usually these attractive art objects. One show, what we did was Sheila Hedy and the photographer Lee Towndrow had this idea that instead of going to the record store and buying a ticket, you would go to this photo studio and have your picture taken. And then Lee, we took pictures of everybody who was going to come to the show, the same people who would normally buy tickets. And then Lee took all of those individual photos and made them into a poster. And then when you came to the show, there was this big, beautiful poster with like 120 people's faces on it. And when you got to the door, instead of handing your ticket to the door person, you would just point to yourself on the poster and the door person would cross you off and then hand you a copy of the poster. So every single person at the show was sitting in the audience holding a poster with a picture of every single person at the show. I think you can see it online. You can find it on our Instagram somewhere. Anyhow, that's a little story from Trampoline Hall for your delectation. Let's get on to this week's episode. I assume it probably contains mature language. The lecture is entitled On Dentistry, and the lecturer is Michael Stacey.
When I decided that I was going to come talk to you tonight about the history of dentistry, my plan was to scour the books for all of the strangest pre-modern superstitions, all of the most flamboyantly dressed charlatans and quacks, and all of the most genuinely terrifying sounding techniques for removing human teeth. My plan was that we would all have a good laugh at the sufferings of the denizens of history. While I was doing this, however, I did find plenty of this strangeness, but I began to feel a little bit of moral angst about it. And I think the crux of it was that injunction that stand-up comedians are supposed to observe against punching down. You know, the idea that there's something unsavory about making fun of people who are already in a pretty tough spot. Well, I don't know about you, but I would consider having to live with the daily reality that my teeth might need to be ripped out without the benefit of anesthesia a pretty tough spot. So in light of that, we are going to talk about something very strange. We're going to talk about the strangest thing in the whole history of dentistry, the toothworm. But I thought we would try and do it. I thought we would try and do it in a spirit of generosity, trying to recognize the creativity and ingenuity and downright pluck of the people who came before us, living through some pretty unpleasant circumstances sometimes. The toothworm is exactly what it sounds like. It is the all-time pan-historical, pan-cultural, pan-global explanation for why your teeth are in terrible pain. And it's just what its name means. It's a tiny, horrible, wriggly guy who has somehow got into your mouth and is inside there chomping away at your chompers. It does not exist, but they believe it everywhere. I think it starts in ancient Egypt, people say, but it's also in the Aztecs, the Greeks, the Romans, the Mesopotamians, medieval Persia, Europe, medieval India and China. They all believe in the toothworm. And if you go on the internet tonight and you ask that you want someone to cure your toothworm, you will find willing helpers. What I thought we would do is first talk about some of the things that people came up with to deal with the tooth worm. Then to ask about why people would believe in the tooth worm, some non-stupid reasons why people from the past believed in this. And finally, in light of those things, I might ask you whether I could say that there was any reason for me to feel better than believers of the tooth worm. So, what could you do about the tooth worm? One of the first documents we have about the existence of the tooth worm comes from ancient Mesopotamia. It's a papyrus fragment, and it shows up just right after the creation myth. So, the worm, he's not yet a tooth worm. He goes to the goddess Ea, and he's like, "Goddess Ea, what am I supposed to eat?" The goddess Ea says, "Don't worry, Mr. Worm, we've got you sorted out. I made these delicious figs, there's ripe cherries, you're gonna love the world." The worm's like, no, I don't want to hear any of that. What I would prefer is if you would lift me up and place me inside the mouth. There I may destroy the tooth, and particularly that soft inner part of the tooth, which is what I most favor. Now, admittedly, this does not actually do anything for the sufferer of the toothache, but by mythologizing it in this way, I think you gain some mental purchase on the phenomenon. And if you're living in ancient Mesopotamia, I think this is an admirably hard-nosed outlook on life. The worm was offered good food. He rejects it in favor of sadism. There is no point in investigating your suffering. You merely have to face it with courage. History moves on, however. The next thing I want to tell you about is not a specific tooth worm cure. It comes from Pliny the Elder, I think 1st century AD, Roman natural historian. But it's so good, even though it's just toothache and not tooth worm, I wanted to share it anyways. Pliny says you have to go out at night and find a frog. And then, once you've caught the frog, you pry the frog's mouth open. I know that that's cruel, but the part about it that bothers me is not the cruelty, but the fact that I just think a frog's mouth is maybe not the sort of thing that's amenable to prying. Anyways, if you succeed in this, you can shout into the frog's mouth, "Frog, take my toothache and go." And this will apparently help. The all-time best thing that anyone comes up with to deal with the tooth worm is from 11th century Persia, another really famous dude, Avicenna, Aristotelian philosopher. Being a man of science, his technique for getting rid of the tooth worm is fumigation. You get yourself a large metal cone. At the base of the cone, you burn some henbane seeds. The smoke from the henbane seeds proceeds up the cone. You put the business end of the cone near the offending tooth, and your tooth worm is kaput. Except what actually happens is that henbane is a truly horrifying-sounding narcotic. And if you are lucky, you are left with a case of nausea and paranoia. And if you're unlucky, I think permanent madness or death results. But in either case, you have much bigger things to worry about now than the tooth worm. Now, given that those are the kind of things that you can do to get rid of a tooth worm, why would otherwise rational people believe in something like this? Well, I read that the ancient Egyptians were pretty focused on the idea of parasites. This is not difficult to understand, I think. Once you have figured out that there is one kind of horrible little wriggly creature that gets inside you and messes everything up, then trying to not see similar horrible wriggly creatures everywhere would become a very difficult job. It's not entirely irrational either, right? They're arguing from something where they understand the causality to another analogous situation where they don't. I know that's not how we do science these days, but in the whole history of human attempts at knowing things, that's far from the worst. There were, of course, cases where it seemed like there was actual physical evidence for the tooth worm. In the henbane story I just described, after you'd burnt the henbane seeds, what was left over were long, white, desiccated filaments that would be shown to the toothache sufferer as evidence that the worms were now dead. There was real ocular proof that the henbane worked. The bigger thing, I think, is that believing in the tooth worm is not in and of itself evidence that you have an overall bad idea of how to do oral hygiene. So I read this paper by some anthropologists who went to very poor villages in rural Brazil. And they're trying to figure out why the villagers are going to see traditional practitioners of medicine who will treat tooth worms rather than going to dentists who will not. And they asked them questions like, "Is there anything I can do to avoid getting the tooth worm?" The villagers reply, "Oh, of course, everyone knows that. You simply avoid eating the kinds of foods that the tooth worm likes to eat." And The researchers, being a bit perplexed, I suspect, ask a follow-up question, which is, what foods does the toothworm like to eat? Which the villagers now, they just think they're dealing with the dumbest people they've ever met, say, everyone knows that. The toothworm loves sweet, sugary treats. Well, sweet, sugary treats, that more or less exhausts 90% of the prescriptive advice that I was ever given about oral hygiene. It actually gets worse if you wanted me to explain what I thought was really going on when your teeth started to rot. In preparing for this lecture, I did learn that it has something to do with bacteria. But if I was then required to explain what bacteria were, I would look worse than the believers of the toothworm. Because I think, more or less, that bacteria are tiny, invisible worms. Now, I do know, I do believe that there is a set of institutions which kind of guarantees that someone out there has the whole rational, testable picture of what happens in the mouth when it goes bad. But I would like to say that that knowledge is not actually instantiated in me, and that I know about as much about real dentistry as any believer in the toothworm, perhaps less. So I wonder if it's okay to stop there and just ask, maybe it would have been okay if I'd tried to just spend these few minutes laughing at the sufferings of our collective foreparents. Because, well, I might have fooled myself, I probably wouldn't have fooled all of you, and you would have seen that behind my laughter there was a fair bit of nervousness. That I was not, in fact, laughing from a position of strength. You see, I've never had a real toothache. My experiences at the dentist have been remarkably pleasant. And the stories that I've told you, they terrify me. There are ones yet worse, which I did not have the courage to relate. If people from the past could look at me, I think they would have reason to believe that, you know, being freed from the shackles of disgustingness and suffering that the toothworm represents, I would have gone on to accomplish some pretty incredible things with my life. But I really could show them no higher ideal that I'd lived in service of than, you know, the relentless pursuit of my own comfort or the avoidance of anything resembling serious toil. I don't want to romanticize the past too much, because that seems like a worse sin, right? That I would now go and take pleasure in the suffering of these people who are dead. But I wonder whether it's even like a little bit possible for them to romanticize me. You know? I have a sixth great grandfather. I mean, I have many of them, but I've learned recently that one of them was named Nazareth. And I don't want to romanticize Nazareth, but, you know, in my mind, he looks a bit like Levon Helm. And what could he see in me other than a cowardly layabout? Can anyone feel the least bit romantic about someone who's never had a toothache? Thank you.
Michael Stacy, ladies and gentlemen. Michael Stacy.
You're listening to the Trampling Hall Podcast. I'm Misha Goldman. Up next, the Q&A.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Are there any questions? Yes, all the way in the back. Yes, you, ma'am.
Can you tell us a really gross thing?
Yeah. Oh, you want to hear the stuff that was too gross to make it into the lecture? Oh. All right.
Okay. One of the really gross things, you know how I said there was physical evidence for the toothworm sometimes. Well, some of the other cures for the toothworm eventually involve just breaking your tooth right open. And when you do that, the soft interior part of the tooth looks very much like a scared and wriggly worm.
Oh, that's horrible. That really is horrible. All right, thanks for asking. Any other questions? Anything else? Any other things people would like to know? Yes, you, ma'am, in the back.
Did you learn anything about the tooth fairy?
Did you learn anything about the tooth fairy?
Strangely, histories of dentistry, perhaps, I don't know, being written by dentists and not wanting to get away from the narrative of everything leading to modern dentistry, shy away from mentioning the tooth fairy very much.
Do you think they're actually hostile to the tooth fairy?
Like, I don't want to say.
All right. That. Yeah, we don't want to go there, I suppose. All right. Any other questions? Anything else you would like to know? Yes. Oh, yes. Yes, you, ma'am.
Does history have a greatest dentist?
Does history have a greatest dentist?
I think history only has great charlatans of dentistry. There was a man in 19th century London who claimed to be able to cure toothaches by handing you a perfumed letter, which you, once in your possession, would cure your toothache. And on his advertisements, he would give the addresses of people whom he had cured by this method, so you could go check it out.
Was that something that people would do at the time? Like, was that a popular advertising thing? Do you know?
I have no idea. Like, it's like a pre-modern Yelp kind of thing, right?
You actually have to go to the guy's house, and he's like, 4 stars. Yeah. Like, okay, I go home. All right. Okay, so there you go. That's the most famous dentist, the letter-writing dentist. Yes, you, ma'am, yes.
Okay, what did you learn or imagine about the future of dentistry?
Well, yeah, what about what of the future of dentistry is the question?
I guess the painful parts of it will go, right? My dentist already apparently has a drill that doesn't make the unpleasant noise anymore.
That really does... People are like... It really does put it into perspective. Like, when you think about, like, the excruciating pain that people would experience with toothache and with dentistry in the past, and that now we're at the point where we're like... Oh, if it didn't make that annoying noise, I guess it would be better. Yeah. Like, that's really...
I couldn't confirm this, but I heard that sometimes they would have bands that would play while dental operations were going on. It seems like you would need to hire the dentist and a whole band of people. It's just relentlessly unproductive.
I wonder if like in among musicians, you think that was like hiring a hierarchy? Like, oh yeah, I'm a dentist band. Oh, that's good. I guess we don't know. I completely lost. So they make the pain. So the future is the less noise from the pain. And is there anything else? Like, any other like future things you imagine will happen?
I guess I don't know. Robot teeth.
What would that mean?
Like they would do your chewing for you if you decided that was sort of a task you didn't feel up to today.
You are ahead of the curve, like in terms of avoiding arduous work. I know you mentioned that, but I hadn't thought of that as being like a toil that one might. Oh, if only the food could be chewed by a machine for me.
Like, you know how a dog, if you're playing with it, knows just how much pressure to apply to your arm without really hurting you?
I do know that.
Like, maybe they could teach humans to know that.
Wait, what do you mean? Don't we already know that? Or is that a problem that you have?
I don't know how much pressure to apply.
With every bite, you're, like, biting too hard? All right, so in the future, there'll be less humming, your teeth will be robots, and humans will have a dog-like ability to control their jaws. That's what we have. Anything else that we would like to know? Yes, over there, yes.
I'm kind of curious, you mentioned early in your lecture that there were theories or myths of the toothworm from different cultures. If it wasn't just kind of the spread of the myth organically through travelers, right. Why is it that
So why the universality of the toothworm myth? Why do so many cultures have it? Do you have a theory on that?
Well, I would just venture. I only heard this about parasites with the Egyptians, but I assume parasites were something that most people knew about just from trial and error, and that You know, or that they're really, like, having never had a toothache, that there really is something specific about the pain where you can feel something almost moving up there. Some of the descriptions you get do sound like people know it's a worm because of the way it feels like a worm.
So people are like, huh, does anyone have that? Has anyone had a toothache and found it to be worm-like in their, anyone here? We'll close our eyes before you raise your hands. So you won't be embarrassed. Have you actually had that? Is that true? And is it true that you felt like something squirming around or something?
Yeah, I totally believe that.
So that's what it feels like. You felt it and you felt... And you're obviously from the present day. But you felt that. Okay, so there you go. So it does. So there we go. So it feels like a worm. People, again, you. I guess other things you can see that they are caused. Other things go wrong and there's a worm inside. You see it. And then that horrible story about breaking it open and you can see the worm inside.
Yeah.
That's the horrible... That story makes me very sad. So there you go. So it's very reasonable. So does that answer your question? Sure, of course it does. Anything else? Yes, you ma'am, yes.
So I'm still trying to understand your creative process in coming to this topic with the overall general topic. Was that really the plan, but you just sort of named it this?
She wanted to know, given that you promised us a talk on dentistry, why was this all just about this worm that doesn't exist? How did that happen?
The history of dentistry is so broad with so many wonderful things in it. There was no way to give you a decent, in sort of 10 minutes, kind of narrative of the whole thing, right? It had to be focused.
Totally irrelevant to the history of dentistry.
Why, you feel this is totally irrelevant to the history of dentistry? Well, dentistry, is that your charge?
It's
very essential. This is
what? You say this has nothing to do with the history of dentistry?
How central is it?
How central? Okay, so she's gonna take back her ludicrous claim that this has nothing to do with the history of dentistry. But how central? How central is
it? It's tremendously central.
There
every great dentist who they put up as the fathers of the enlightenment of dentistry has their own personal story about how they came to not believe in the tooth worm anymore. So he's not a dentist, but I think von Leeuwenhoek, the microscope guy, one of the Renaissance microscope experts, he was, one of the things he wanted to figure out was whether the tooth worm was real. And so he got some tooth worms from someone who removes them, put them under the microscope, and he was like, ah, no, these are just cheese worms. And so he was, you know, that was instrumental in kind of like our understanding that you could do stuff with microscopes. And later, the guy's name's Fauchard, Pierre Fauchard. He's considered the real, like, I don't know, 18th century master of scientific dentistry. He said he couldn't confirm that the tooth worm didn't exist. Very, very like Voltaire-like, but he had no proof that it did.
It's an enlightenment story. It's wonderful.
So there you go. You felt bad about it, and now you feel good. Is that right? That's a very successful Q&A exchange. That's how you understand things and you feel better. Does anyone else feel bad and misunderstand and want to have that problem remedied? Any other questions from the audience? Anything else people would like to know? Oh, you're over there. Yes, I'm sorry. It's so dark where you are.
Yeah.
That narcotic that you mentioned, does it have other uses?
You want to know more about the narcotic? What?
So far as I know, according to some legend, henbane is the stuff that was put in Hamlet's dad's ear to kill him. So you can also ear poison with it.
So it cures non-existent diseases and kills fictional characters. Those are its two main applications. Do you think that things are different now? Do you think that that's like this notion? Do you think that in general people just had more like physical pain in their life in the past? Like, is that a across-the-board thing?
I mean, I think here in Toronto, it's pretty easy to avoid. I always wanted more pain avoidance mechanisms. Like, I feel like some sort of opiate EpiPen should be available to
just
people
in case
bad happens.
Like, if you skin your knee, skin your knee, you're like, turn that off, like, whatever. So, like, always, we should never have to experience any physical pain at all.
Well, no, except that you might worry that you were living this thin, kind of truncated existence.
Well, and that's right. So do you think it's in some ways better? Like, is it better than to have that physical pain?
I was thinking about this on the way over. I think 99 days out of 100, you would rather live in the painless world. Once in a while, there might be some benefit.
What would be that day? What would be the... Like, I understand what you're saying, and yet I can't imagine when you would ever choose it. Like,
The day you wanted to know you weren't a coward and you wanted some proof that you had lived through something non-cowardly.
Like
Right. So just that. So just to be like, oh, I'm not a coward because I had a toothache.
Yeah. It's a start.
It's a start. It's such a weak proof. But I guess it's something. Someone with a better question than me had their hand up, I think. Yes, you ma'am. Yes.
So I imagine you have to have a fairly complex society to have dentists. So I'm curious if you discovered anything about the types of people who treated toothaches when they did not have dentists.
So the question is, who treats toothaches in societies that aren't complex enough to have a special dentist class, as our society does?
That's a good one. I know Herodotus, the Greek historian, he was amazed at the Egyptians because they had specialization down to the point where there was one doctor just for dentists. But I guess, I assume that in sort of, you know, places where there was less of that division of labor going on, you had someone who was responsible for all bad, painy type things, and you might address them using, you know, the same toolkit. But that's just idle speculation.
Right. That's just, the answer is doctors. Like, it seems like a very obvious, like, just doctors. Yeah, and then, I guess before doctors, just like the guy who does things. Go to the guy. Does that answer your question?
If there were priests or people.
Oh, if there were priests, maybe would priests did they evolve from priests?
I didn't find a whole lot of like intertwinings of religious and ceremonial roles and the getting rid of the tooth pain, which seems like really weird. You would imagine that you would just go to the same person who would help you with the tooth and then the afterlife if necessary.
But those were actually separate. Those were always separate.
I'm sure not always.
All right. Okay. But that is surprising. It is surprising. Anything else? Anything else you want to know? Yes, over there. Yes, in the back. Yes.
Did you ever see any visual representations of the toothworm?
Did you see visual representations of the toothworm? It's an
there
excellent
is
question.
There is one very famous representation, and it's this. I think it's like a piece of jewelry or something. It's a tooth that has been hollowed out, and on the interior of the tooth, there is a depiction of humans wrestling with the toothworm. It's French. It's from, I don't know, somewhere between the Renaissance and now. But you can see it on the internet.
maybe you can spend the rest of you can visual it in your mind's eye throughout the rest of the break. It seems like a nice place to wrap up. Ladies and gentlemen, Michael Stacy. Trampoline Hall was created in Toronto in the 21st century by Sheila Hetty and is hosted by me. This episode's lecture was chosen by Mark Slutsky. The podcast is produced by Josh Block. Our theme music was composed by Matt Smith. Trampoline Hall is a Sumo Audio podcast. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. If you enjoyed the podcast, why not leave a review or rating on iTunes? It really helps us a lot, so we appreciate it if you can do that. I'm Misha Globerman. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.